I have a little bit of a bio that I want to read about Brother Hollingsworth. Guy Hollingsworth currently serves as an associate academic vice president at BYU-Idaho and has worked in higher education for over 20 years. He grew up in Preston, Idaho, and is married to the former Christine Davenport. Guy and Chris are the parents of two children, Morgan and Cade. Colonel Hollingsworth has spent 37 years in the Army National Guard and Army Reserve. Some time ago, he returned from a 400-day deployment to Iraq, where he served as the director of training for the Iraq Army and as the senior advisor to the Iraq Chief of Staff over training. He's being deployed in 2 weeks for another year, this time in Afghanistan, as the Department of Defense lead for the Afghan Threat Finance Cell. Among other awards, he is a recipient of the Iraq Campaign Medal, the Merit Service Medal, and the Bronze Star. He is also a former recipient of the General Douglas MacArthur Leadership Award, recognized as a top company grade officer in the country. Last year, he was inducted into the Army Officer Candidate School of Hall of Fame in Fort Benning, Georgia. Dr. Hollingsworth holds a bachelor's degree in advertising from Brigham Young University, a master's degree in curriculum and instruction from Idaho State University, and a PhD in education from the University of Idaho. He is also a graduate of the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College and holds a second master's degree in strategic studies from the U.S. Army War College. His military expertise in the counterinsurgency and counterterrorism. So that's pretty impressive. So without further ado, Guy Hollingsworth.
It's nice to be with you this morning. I'm flattered that you would come. Because I was fearful that you wouldn't. So thank you for coming, getting up early. I live in Idaho Falls, and I got up earlier than I wanted to this morning to get here. You probably did too, so thank you. I prayed that a few things I say this morning will be of merit to you and of worth, and that you'll walk out and think, yeah, that was worth my time. I've been in lots of these kinds of things where I wasn't sure that it was worth my time. I hope that it is this morning. So it's great to be with you. I have a few slides to keep you awake. I want to talk about a couple different things. I'm not so sure that there's a lot of rhyme or reason to some of what I'm going to talk about, but I hope there is. As you go through your life, and you have a lot of it in front of you, there'll be some surprises that'll come along, and the challenge for you will be how to handle it. Like this young paratrooper is probably trying to decide how to handle things when he hits the ground. As was mentioned, my expertise in the military is counterinsurgency and counterterrorism. That's why I went to Iraq for a year, was to teach the Iraqi army how to do those kinds of things. And with that comes some other pieces that all get rolled up into what's called special operations. And that's really what I am, is a special operations officer. That's why I'm going to Afghanistan next Monday for 400 days that I'll never get back for another year. But before I was a special operations guy, I initially was a field artilleryman, a combat arms officer for a number of years. And I'm proud to claim that I still am an artilleryman, although I'm not so sure you'd want to get me in an artillery piece without a pretty good refresher course. Been a long time. This is a self-propelled 155 howitzer known as an M109. That's me on top a long time ago, 20, 25 years ago. or so, more than that maybe, actually, closer to 30 years ago. This is my crew. I was an enlisted soldier at that time, had not gained a commission, was not an officer. You can't see those people very well, but good folks. This is the workhorse of the Army when it comes to conventional warfare. That's what it's known as. Artillery has the nickname of King of Battle, and for a good reason. This is a 22-ton machine. It's not a tank. It's an indirect weapon system. It fires around 30 kilometers downrange. That's what artillery does. It's an indirect weapon system. Tanks are much heavier, much more mobile, and they're a direct weapon system. They see the target. They weigh about 60 tons. They're a thick-skinned vehicle. This is a thin-skinned vehicle. And it'll roll about 50 miles an hour if you let it. And so it's they're pretty fun to drive. They really are pretty fun to drive. They fire a round that weighs 96.7 pounds. It's a heavy round. And if you are the number one man, as they call him, the number one man, you get a workout if you're in the middle of fire missions, because you are picking up 100 pounds, putting it on a big tray that rams a hydraulic push into the tube, and you're doing lots of things that make you break a sweat, and you do that over and over again. That artillery piece that I showed you fires different kinds of rounds. It will fire chemical rounds. It will fire white phosphorus rounds, and it will fire a copperhead round, and the conventional piece that it fires, which is the round on the left, is a high explosive round. Don't be misled by that little piece of metal. That is a lethal weapon system, and if one of those rounds goes off within 50 meters after you've been bracketed, as they say, you're in trouble. Those things explode, and there is some real tough, ugly things inside that do bad things to people and to facilities if need be. These are a couple of my colleagues in Afghanistan. When the round goes off, it makes a big bang. If you like big bangs, this is as good as it gets. You pull the lanyard that is about 3 feet long at the end of that tube, and that recoils about 6 feet and rocks back on some big spades on the back of that piece of equipment, and that whole piece just rocks back. There are 5 people that make up the crew. 4 of them are inside. It's pretty tight quarters. But to stand back and to watch that fire is pretty impressive. It's too bad that we have to have that kind of thing in this world, but at times it's needed. I can tell you that because of machines like this and tanks that I won't talk about and other kinds of lethal weapon systems like Apache warships and other combat multipliers, I doubt that you will see the United States ever again in a full-fledged conventional war, because no one can compete with us. We are generations ahead of anybody in the world with our equipment, and it just is not a fair fight. That may sound arrogant, rightfully so. With these artillery pieces that fire these very heavy rounds, downrange 30 kilometers, when that round leaves the tube, there are grooves inside of the tube that spin the round to the right very quickly, like most munitions do for accuracy. And as those grooves do their job of spinning that round out of that tube, and as it heads downrange very fast, there is what's called artillery drift. that takes place. In other words, as it spins to the right, it slightly veers to the right by the time it hits the target because it's spinning that way. It's called artillery drift. And smarter people than me, who have backgrounds in physics and other kinds of science, have put together tables to help artillerymen adjust to the drift. And it depends on what the atmosphere is doing, what the conditions are, what the weather is like, what's your elevation, different kinds of things that make that drift do different things. And those tables help an artilleryman to hit the target and to adjust for that artillery drift that takes place. In our lives, we have drift, whether we like it or not. It comes our way based on our circumstances. It might spin one direction or the other in our case, but we need to know what's necessary to adjust that drift in our lives. And most of you know some of those things that keep you on the straight path, if you will. There's some that aren't as good at adjusting to the drift in life. I will tell you this morning that life will not go as planned for most of you. There will be a very few of you who will have the white picket fence around your house, and life indeed will unfold as you imagine. But for most of you, I can assure you that you will be blindsided. You will be hit with things that you did not expect. Count on it. If you look at my life, and I'm an old man at this point, at least feel that way sometimes, this is me in the second grade. How about that hair, huh? This is in 1967, I think. Or 67, maybe 68. If you had told me as a young boy, and even as a young man your age, that 25 years later, after I was sitting where you are in this very auditorium as a student at Ricks College, if you had told me that many years from now, Mr. Hollingsworth, Brother Hollingsworth, you will be on the Iranian border waiting for your Black Hawk helicopters to refuel so you can pick up and go. And each one of those Black Hawks, you can't see them, have crew-serve weapons that are armed and ready that stick out of both sides of those weapons, or out of those Black Hawks. By the way, Black Hawk helicopters are really fun to fly in. I flew in one several times a week, every week for a year, because I had dedicated Black Hawk support based on my responsibilities. I never got tired of riding in them. There's something about it. But anyway, that's beside the point. If you'd told me that I would be doing this when I sat where you are, no, not me. You have the wrong person. You have the wrong person. And I can tell you, I teach a class on Pakistan here on campus. Yesterday was my last day with my class. Someone else will pick it up for me to finish the semester. The next time my class will see me will be on a Skype on a big screen like this in class in a month or so from Kabul, Afghanistan. And I'll try to touch base with them at that point. But I tell them and I tell you that life will be different. And if you don't take it upon yourself to stretch a bit and to adjust for the drift that'll come into your life, then you will see trouble that may not be corrected, or those around you who you have the responsibility to raise will see trouble. and may not be able to adjust if you don't plan now for that. Because I can tell you, and I'm sure there's many of you that have been on missions to different places around the world, but you need to plan now for your children to speak languages like Urdu and Pashtun and Arabic. And your sons and daughters will go to places like Kabul and Jalalabad and Islamabad and Kashmir and places that we don't go now. And you may have grown up in the little town of Preston, Idaho, like me, where nobody in my high school, no one in my high school was not LDS. I didn't know anyone who was not LDS in my high school. Some of you maybe have that background. I bet a bunch of you don't. And then to be exposed to things in my life that have happened and will happen in your life, strange places for you and for your children, that will happen. Prepare now to be able to handle that. I can tell you that I spent some time last week with Elder Bednar in his office. And he said something to me in a blessing. And he said the same thing to me 4 years ago when I left for Iraq. He said it again last week as I get ready to head to Afghanistan. He said, prepare well, my friend. Prepare well. And I say the same to each of you as you think about the drift that will come, and it will come, to prepare well, to handle that, to make the right calculations in your life. I think it's important too, this is the second point I want to make this morning, to not only take it upon yourself to adjust your life in an appropriate manner, in a righteous manner for those, that drift I speak of, but I think it's your responsibility to look around you here and wherever you are for others who may need that help. I saw a young man on campus last week who reminded me of someone I grew up with, and I was reminded of a painful story that took place in my life. I'll share it with you. It's a sad story, but I think if you'll allow me to tell, I don't want to ruin your day, but it's important to make a point. As I said, I grew up in Preston, Idaho, a little farming community. I grew up outside of town and on a farm, and I milked cows for a number of years by hand and moved sprinkler pipe and hauled hay a lot. Long days. I did that all growing up. Now, I want you to know, and some of you may have grown up in that kind of environment, I wouldn't trade that for anything in the world. It's the best way for a young man to grow up. I really wouldn't trade it for anything. I just never want to do it again, ever. And when I go home to Preston and see my siblings who still do those kinds of things and took a different path in life, and I guess you would consider them blue collar, but they're really smart guys, my brothers. They're mechanics and machinists and welders, and they can fix anything and build anything and do anything. They really are those kind of people that just can do whatever. And I always get asked the question when I go home, what can't the educated one do today? I always get that. And then I get something like, how could we have grown up on the same farm and you know so little? But anyway, we all choose our path. But I grew up on this little farm, and on the farm next to mine, which was a half mile away, there was a young man who was my age. His name was David. He was in my ward. And at a very young age, I realized that he was a little different. Didn't think much about it as a little boy. He actually spoke with a lisp and was just a little different. But I used to go over there as a little kid and play with him, and he'd come to my house occasionally, and we'd play as kids. He wasn't very coordinated, as I recall. And his mom scared me. But anyway, I'd go over and play a little bit and vice versa. And anyway, we got older and it became time to get involved in sports like you are. And I can tell you that no one loved the game of baseball more than me. I loved it as a kid and lived for it. And it was a mile to town to go to baseball, to Little League, to the park, City Park. And even on days when the radio, the little local radio station would say, if it were raining, and it would say, there's no baseball today because it's raining, and it would devastate me. And I would still, I remember many times, I would still get on my little Stingray bike and I would ride the mile and a half or whatever to the park in the rain with my mitt just to see if anybody might show up to play catch, even though we weren't having practice. I just loved baseball. That doesn't mean I was any good at it, but I loved to play the game. I missed playing baseball. They should have leagues for old guys to play baseball. Can you work on that? I don't know, maybe, Trent, can you work on, maybe on campus? Anyway, I love the game. And Little League practice came one summer, and David, who had not played sports and wasn't very coordinated, I said to his mother, will you let him come and play? And she said, okay. And so he would ride with me up to the park every day on our bikes. And at the first of that one particular summer, there was no scientific way of choosing teams that back then. Maybe there still isn't. I don't know. We would choose teams, and you would pick 8 different people to be the captain. And those were people that usually understood the game a bit better and had some coordination. And then they would just look at all the boys that were there, and you would say, I'll take him, and I'll take him, and you know how you do, and you would go all the way through, and then you'd start over, and you'd pick your teams that way. And I was one of those guys that picked players, and I'll take him, and the next round I'd take the next best, you know, the draft. So, and as you might suspect from what I've said, David, I remember this particular summer, the first year he played, he was one of those guys that is left to the end. And I picked David in the very last round, I'm sure, if we call it that. The last few, David, I'll take you. And thought, what will he do on the team this year? You know, get out in right field, you know, and hope the ball doesn't get hit your way. I don't know. Anyway, we had a pretty good time that summer, as I recall. And he got to be a little better, but he really was not much of an athlete. And then some years passed, and I got into junior high, and there was really only 2 things that mattered to me in my life. 2 things. In this order. Sports and young ladies. That's what mattered in my life. And as you get into junior high, if you think back, then you, all of a sudden there becomes a little more of a pecking order on negotiating your way through each day. And when it comes to the opposite sex, and in my case, young ladies, and that pecking order was very important. And lots of ways that I think most of you understand. And I remember David would say, hey, let's, I guess the term now is hang out, but I say, hey, let's do some things together. And as I got into junior high and into this early high school, I remember starting to think, you know, you've got that lisp, and you are still a bit different. And yeah, we were friends as kids, but I'm not sure it's in my best interest to hang with you. Just doesn't feel, what will she think? Kind of thing. And I remembered thinking that. And so I made up reasons to sort of separate myself from him a bit. And we got a little further into high school, and I remember he asked me a time or two if he could double date with me. And I think I did it one time, but on the other times that he asked me, again, I applied some excuse on a regular basis to separate myself from his indifference or his differentness. I didn't think it was in my best interest based on what I was thinking I needed to do. A popularity thing and all those pieces that most of you know what I'm talking about. And others did a bit of that with him as well. And consequently, as we got into the last year or two of high school, he found some new friends. They weren't very good friends, because that's who would accept him. And he took up a pretty nasty habit of drinking. Marlboros became his best friend. Started to use some drugs that weren't kind to him. And I remember thinking now as a senior in high school, as I recall, thinking, boy, glad I cleared myself of him. Because look what he's become. He's drinking, he's smoking, he's carousing, he's causing trouble. He's hanging out with losers. Boy, the best thing I ever did was to separate myself from him. Best thing I ever did. 2 weeks before I graduated from high school, we, with our best girlfriends, several of us, you know, the Letterman jacket kind of people, went up the canyon to have a little, build a bonfire and made s'mores and had a gay old time, wonderful time, great night with my girlfriend and my guys with their girlfriend buddies and really had a nice time. And I remember distinctly across the way, this group of people that David had tied to were having their own party. And you could smell the party, if you know what I mean. You could smell the party. And again, I remember thinking, ah, boy, glad I separated myself there. That's trouble. Look what he's become, and look at those other guys. Ugh. We closed up, put the fire out, went home at a respectable hour, as I recall. And all was well. Had a great time. The next morning, I found out that David, who came down the Narrows, we called it the Narrows, it was a reservoir that you'd drive up a very narrow gravel road to get to, was the favorite spot. And a little bit treacherous, but you had to be careful as you drove up and down, especially at night. That night, late, or early morning, however you want to say it, he came down the canyon too, down the Narrows, in his old green pickup. It was a Dodge, I still recall in my mind what it looked like. Drunk and out of control in the truck, and it spun off of that gravel road and into the Bear River. Upside down. And David drowned that night. And the next day, his mother called me and said, you know, David always thought a lot about you, appreciated your friendship, and I wonder if you would sing at his funeral. Few other people. And I remember the song we sang. It was called No Man Is an Island. Now, you probably can't see it from where you're sitting, but on my right leg around my ankle is a chain, and at the end there's a ball. And I've drug that around with me for 35 years. And I might be a bit harsh on myself, maybe, because I've asked many times for forgiveness, to include his family later on. But the chain's still there. The ball still drags. I suspect it will drag for the rest of my life, because I could have done something different for someone who had some serious drift. Some of that drift, probably my fault. Don't do that. Look around you today, tomorrow, next week. Look for those who have a bit of a challenge with that drift. You all know them, don't you? They're here on this campus, I can assure you. There might be a David in the room here this morning. There might be. I ask you to look a little bit at those around you that may need some help with that issue, that drift. And it takes more than just a few minutes of let me know if I can be of help. My wife has had some serious health trouble over the years. She's had 3 kidney transplants. Spent a number of years on a dialysis machine. Not a very pleasant thing. And at one particular occasion, she had been in the hospital for a number of weeks. I was a student at BYU at the time. I had 2 children. I was trying to finish school. I was working 2 jobs. She was in the hospital, couldn't take care of my kids. I was a full-time student as well. And so my daughter, who was 4 or 5 at the time, I sent to Idaho Falls from Provo to be with my mother-in-law for a time until I could get my wife out of the hospital. And my little boy, who was a toddler, I sent to Preston to my mother. And so I had my family farmed out, my wife in the hospital, and I got up after a nap of a couple of hours to go work a job stocking shelves at a grocery store at midnight. I got up at 11:30 one night, very tired, very miserable, wondering how did I get myself into this, worrying about my wife and my children. Got up, putting on my clothes. I get a knock on the door at 11:30 at night in my little apartment, basement apartment. And I'm not in a very good mood. And I'm thinking, who's bothering me? I don't have time for you. It's too late. Why are you knocking on my door? I went to answer the door, and there standing in front of the door is Sister Erickson, an 80-year-old sister that lives 2 doors up the hill. I said, Sister Erickson, what are you doing? It's 11:30. Go home. Go to bed. What are you doing? She said to me, I can't stand it any longer. I can't. I am not leaving until I've done something for your family. I said, I don't have anything for you. It's very kind of you. Thanks. I don't have anything for you. She said, no, I won't accept it. She said, I'll stand here all night if I have to. This is an 80-year-old woman. I'll stand here all night if I have to. I'm not leaving until I've done something for your family. Come on in. I gathered up some dirty clothes, put it in a bag, and gave her a bag of dirty clothes. I said, if you could wash these, it'd be great. And we visited for a minute. And next day, they came back. She brought them back, and they were folded like they'd been through a Chinese dry cleaning establishment. They were perfect. I hadn't seen them like that since I bought them in the store. I mean, just the underwear was, everything was just perfectly folded. It was perfect. And she did that for me for, I don't know, a number of weeks, number of times. And you know, that's what it takes. For those of you, and I suspect most of you are home teachers and visiting teachers, throw out the words. Everybody look at me like I say to my kids. Everybody look at me. Kids look at me while I say this. Throw out the words out of your vocabulary. Let me know if we can be of any help. I don't want to see anybody raise their hand, but I ask you the question, how many have said that when you've gone home teaching or visiting teacher? Let me know if you need anything. I've done it before. And I can tell you, nobody lets you know. Nobody does. They won't do it. Throw the words out and never use them again, ever, as long as you have the assignment to be a home teacher and a visiting teacher. Because what it takes is the Sister Erickson approach to stand in front of the door or whatever and say, I'm not leaving until I've done something for you. Or you just do it anonymously. And I've had plenty of those things happen to me in my life. That's maybe what it takes. Not maybe, I'll throw that word out to it. That's what it should be, to help someone around you. How many have seen the movie Old Yeller? Remember Old Yeller? This is Mr. Searcy. The setting is the Civil War. It's not a very good picture, but it's all I can find. The setting is the Civil War. All the men have gone off to fight in the Civil War. The wives and the children are left back home. Mr. Searcy is left at home as well to take care of the families. But he's a freeloader. In the movie, he rides up on his horse to this family that owns the dog, Old Yeller. And he says, boy, it's great to be here with you. How you doing? I'm here to check on you. What's for dinner? And he sits down and eats their food, chats, goes on for a while. What do you need? And this particular mother that's in the movie said, well, gee, we need a lot of things. The corn needs to come into the crib. There's some work to be done. Could you give a hand? He said, well, I'm busy, but my daughter, I'll leave her. She's 10. She can help bring in the corn from the field. I'll leave my 10-year-old. I got to go. And he jumps on his horse and says, hey, you know what? Let me know if you need something. And he rides off. He's kind of a goofy guy. Watch the movie. But how many of us do that when we get in our car? Those that maybe have experienced a bit of drift in their life, we could apply the corrections, and we jump on our horse and ride away. Let me know. I ask that you be sensitive to that. Well, I'll finish up here. What else do I have? You're gonna get blindsided by some things that, like I said, that won't be pleasant to you in life. It's just part of life. And be grateful for the challenge. Know that the Lord loves you and wants to press you to be better, and that's what it takes, is some challenge. Now, I'm not so sure it'll be this kind of challenge. This is in the green zone in Baghdad. But you sort of might see some signs that feel that way to you at times. And things that look to create drift in your life, or to put it in front of you. And I ask you to be ready for that. Take it upon yourself to live your lives in such a way where the drift is controlled, and look around you at others who might need some of that correction as well. And do it kindly and in a genuine manner, and you'll be better for it. I suspect there'll be some folks that I'll meet in Afghanistan here in the coming days that will have a bunch of drift in their life. It's the reason I'm going there, I suspect. And I'll look for opportunities. I leave you with this. I say to you the same thing that Elder Bednar said to me. Prepare well, my friends. Prepare well. And part of that is an education. Now, everybody look at me. Don't leave. I say again, don't leave this place until you have a degree. Don't do it. Do not leave. People told me that, and I didn't listen. And it took me 13 years to get a bachelor degree. 13 years. Don't do that. Now, some of you are married and maybe have to follow a spouse. I got it. But for most of you, you're going to dictate your education. Don't leave. Don't go until it's done. Don't mop up later like I did. That's part of preparing to take care of family and to serve in the kingdom. And finally, as you prepare, I admonish you to do all you can to stay close to the Lord, to do those things necessary to control the drift in your life that Satan will throw at you, to strengthen your testimony of the Savior, and to look to do that through your own study and effort and through looking around at others who need the help as well. There'll be chances even today for that, that will help prepare you, that'll stack up line upon line. There will be Davids in your life. Today, maybe. Look for those opportunities as you prepare to do great things, and all of you will do great things. Some you don't expect to do, but you'll do it. And that preparation will help you as you make your journey through life. May the Lord bless you in your studies, to include your spiritual studies. May He bless you to strengthen your conviction and your relationship with the Savior. May He bless you as you go through your life looking for ways to control that drift. And I leave that message with you in the sacred name of Jesus Christ. Amen.